Colorado Court of Appeals. On my right is Judge Roman, on my left Judge Jones, and I'm Judge Miller. We have two cases scheduled for argument this afternoon for our 1:30 sitting, Lugo versus Cooksey and People versus Spiros. Are counsel for both cases here and checked in?
Yes, Your Honor.
Great. We'll start in just a minute, so have a seat. We're going to hear the Lugo case first, and then we'll hear argument in the Spiros case. Before we begin the arguments, let me review a few of our procedures to make sure everybody is familiar with them. First, there will be 15 minutes of oral argument for each side. As you know, we have a digital timing system which shows you exactly how much time you have left in your argument. If the appellant wants to save time for argument, you can just close your opening argument whenever you want to leave that amount of time. You do have a clock in front of you, and the rebuttal time will be reflected on that digital clock. We still have traditional lighting. Yellow means 5 minutes to go. Green means you can start your argument, and red is when your time is gone. You should be aware that all members of the panel have read the briefs, and at least one of us has looked at the record. So you may wish to just go straight to your legal issues rather than review the facts, but of course how you do your argument is up to you. There's a toggle switch on the lectern that allows you to adjust it up, the height up and down as you choose. Please don't stray during your argument, stray from the microphone, because we record it. And in that regard, if you have confidential information, you need to be aware that the recording will show up on the internet in a few days, so any confidential information you probably will not want to disclose. If anyone in the courtroom has a cell phone or a pager, please make sure that it's turned off so it doesn't interrupt us during oral arguments. And we'll now hear argument in Lugo versus Cooksey, so counsel may please go forward to your tables, and appellant, start whenever you're ready.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. My name is Harlan Pels, registration number 5639, appearing on behalf of the appellants. The case being decided here is whether or not it was an abuse of discretion for the trial judge to not find that the defendants in this case, Marie Lugo and Chris Warner, were the prevailing parties and award them their attorney fees. We are aware of the Spencer case. We are aware that Spencer holds that the prevailing party is the person who prevails on the issue of liability. But we suggest to you that this case is different and it's unique. First of all, the trial court's determination of which party prevailed is subject to the abuse of discretion standard. And the court has to do an ad hoc evaluation of the facts and circumstances. What we suggest is what the trial court did was abuse its discretion by considering impermissible factors or fails to consider the appropriate factors and the law. And what has happened in this case was that this case was originally a 126 averment complaint of 25 pages long against various parties, two of which were Marie Lugo and Chris Warner, who signed a contract to purchase the real estate. Well, a default judgment was entered against them for $561,000, which was ultimately set aside by the court. And the issue that was really before the court was whether the provision of the contract providing for zero damages in case of default was enforceable. What the plaintiff attempted to do to this case, by the way, is to really convert it into a tort case. And if the court has read the briefs, on the motion to dismiss, the 12B5 motion to dismiss, the court will find that the judge said The question of whether the Warner defendants acted in bad faith regarding their failure to fulfill their obligation under the contract is not for the court to decide and should be submitted to the finder of fact. That makes this case a little bit different. And this is precisely the case that Justice Rivera discussed in his dissent in Spencer. This is the case where the parties, both sophisticated investors, entered into a contract that provided for zero damages. And if Spencer is followed, that means that the plaintiff can do one of two things. They can bring a claim for breach of contract and prevail and get no damages, or they can bring a claim for breach of contract and get damages. In our view, that's patently unfair. That's not what this statute should be about, and this is what Judge Rivera talked about. That's why the court needs to look at the factors, several other factors, more in the tort line as to who is the prevailing party. Because here, there's no question that the plaintiff lost. There was a minute order that was entered and said, judgment shall enter on behalf of Christopher Warner and Marie Lugo. The court made statements on the record that she believed that the defendants had breached the contract. The court did not take into consideration the testimony from the loan broker, who said she informed Mr. Cooksey that the property appraised for only 50% of what it should have, and the lender was not going to loan any more than the appraised value.
So, counsel, excuse me for interrupting, but it's your position that under the circumstances, your client was free to breach the contract in any way it saw fit, or he saw fit, she saw fit, they saw fit.
They saw fit.
and without any consequence whatsoever.
That's the contract they entered into. The court found they're both.
Is that a contract?
Well, that's a good question, and maybe there's a fit.
If it's not a contract, then you don't have a claim for attorney's fees, do you?
That's true, and they shouldn't have proceeded either. They shouldn't have proceeded on the case, and they did. And they attempted to proceed on a case alleging bad faith breach of contract. And we know that in contract law, bad faith breach of contract is simply a breach of contract. But there was the attempt that was made. The judge said that that issue was going to be decided during the trial. And unfortunately, in this case, Mr. Cooksey passed away. But the fact of the matter is, based upon the evidence that was presented, and the evidence was that our clients did not provide them notice of their that they weren't going to close. And under these particular circumstances, under these particular facts, the plaintiff gets nothing. And under these particular facts, that's not unreasonable. And again, this is the very case that Judge Rivera anticipated in his dissent in the Spencer case.
Counsel, if the trial court found that the defendants breached the contract, why don't we presume nominal damages with that?
Well, in this particular case, they couldn't, because the contract said they couldn't. I would agree with you that normally, if you have a breach of contract, that the prevailing parties, well, the party's entitled to nominal damages of $1.
And therefore attorney's fees.
But that didn't happen here. There was no $1 award. The court found specifically that based upon the sophistication of these parties, this provision of the contract was enforceable. And that's what makes it different. And that's why they're entitled to proceed. Because if you look at what really happened, was that reasonable for them to pursue a claim for damages when they signed a contract, an attorney signs a contract saying that his remedy is limited to retention of earnest money and there is none? we're talking about sophisticated parties. We're not talking about the typical person who engages in a real estate agreement.
The earnest money was zero. I understand that, or it said NA. Did it address nominal damages at all in the contract?
No, there was no nominal damages addressed in the contract.
Did the trial court address it in any way in its order?
No. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for...
You have 7 minutes.
Thank you.
If it pleases the court, Charles Torres on behalf of the appellee and cross appellant. Your Honor, this is, I think, an interesting case because it's one of the few times where we get to see a case like Spencer where the issue is framed very well by both the majority and the dissent, and they specifically address the issue that's up before you now, and that is whether or not you have to have damages in order to be the prevailing party. And I think Judge Rivera went into great detail and made a very good argument for the dissent position, and I think Spencer did a very good job of reviewing a number of other decisions in a number of other states and coming to its conclusion. And I think, and obviously the courts have read those opinions and are very familiar with them. What's important in this particular case is that the complaint specifically alleged a contract breach. When we get to the trial court level, and the court acting as finder of fact has to make a decision in this particular case, the court in the middle of the trial, in response to a question by counsel, specifically points out, I have two issues to decide here today. That is, one, whether or not there was a breach, and if there was a breach, then we make a determination as to whether or not there are any damages in this case. And in this particular case, the court early on determined and allowed it to go to trial. The court made a determination that it could not determine just as a matter of law whether or not the liquidation clause was unconscionable. The court later made that determination and indicated, and this is all in the record, that her law clerk just happened to find a case out of the 10th Circuit that was decided, I think, by Judge Babcock at the district court level, that indicated that the level of sophistication changes the unconscionable standard where you have two parties like Mr. Cooksey, who was an attorney, and Ms. Lugo, who was a real estate agent. And that was a determining factor in her going no further on the liquidated damage clause. But I don't think that the court could have been any more clear in its decision or in its instructions to the parties as we litigated the case at trial that the breach was one of the issues of liability that had to be decided before you even get to the issue of attorney's fees. And I think in that regard, I think Spencer and Nury made it very clear you don't even have to have nominal damages. In Nury, you had a landlord-tenant dispute, if I recall correctly. And in that particular case, the landlord was not entitled to get anything. And so even though there was not a nominal damage or a money damage argument there, just the very fact that somebody prevailed on the contract dispute, that entitled them to attorney's fees. I think to some degree, counsel kind of confuses this idea that what we're trying to accomplish is we do not want to allow a breaching party to benefit from his or her breach and award them with attorney's fees. In this particular case, Mr. Cooksey's estate was the prevailing party on the issue of breach of contract, and in that regard, regardless of what damages he may or may not have been entitled to, because either there was a issue of nominal damages, a liquidated damage clause, or whether it was just a question of whether or not a contract dispute had to be resolved, in that particular case, the prevailing party should be awarded attorney's fees in this particular case. And I think it is somewhat telling that the appellants in this case, in their original argument to the court on attorney's fees, used the Spencer case to make their particular argument that they were the prevailing party and have now moved in an entirely different direction. In any event, I think it's very important that we stay consistent where we have a very clear pronouncement by the Colorado Supreme Court on an issue, that we follow that to the T, and that in this particular case, that the cross appellant, State of Cooksey, should be entitled to award of attorney's fees for prevailing on its particular claim in its civil complaint. Thank you.
Mr. Torres, I have a question for you. I want to ask you about the timeliness of your request in the trial court for attorney's fees. As I read the rule, you had 15 days from the entry of judgment to make that request. In my looking at the record, it didn't appear that you filed your motion within 15 days. It appeared that the appellants filed a motion within 15 days. After the 15 days has expired, you filed your motion. So wasn't your motion untimely?
It was, but I believe the court in because I did not look at that before I came in here to be absolutely correct on this. I think I did indicate to the court in my request, asked to file it outside of time, but I may not have. But in any event, I believe the district court has that discretion to allow me to. She could have just as well turned me down and said, you're outside, so I'm not going to consider it.
I did see, I don't know if it was a request, but some, perhaps it was a request for additional time in your motion. The problem I have with that is that Rule 6 indicates that such a request has to be made before the time expires. In other words, before the 15 days expires, and it clearly was not here.
Judge, you may be right, but I thought, I read in the rules, and again, you probably know this better than I do, that I could file that pro non tunc and that the court could make a determination as to whether or not to allow that within the time limit.
Thank you.
Let me ask you a question, too, if I may, counsel. What about the Western Distributing case, which says that proving actual damages is one of the elements of a breach of contract claim? Doesn't that foreclose your argument that you won on the liability issue?
If I understand, I think the appellant raised the issue that there were, like, I think I said there were four elements. He said five. Five would have included the damage element. I do not think that's consistent with, one, the jury instructions or the logic that is laid out in Nuri and then Spencer in the cases that go thereafter, because you can have liability determined without there being a damage issue. And you see that, again, as examples in Spencer and in Nuri, where you have parties that prevailed but did not get any damages. And so I do not think that is a necessary element. And I would have thought that in that very good discussion between Judge Rivera and the majority in Spencer, that the court would have taken that into consideration and said, you know what, there may be cases where damages are very much an element of a contract, and you must have all four or five elements, and you can't have just a liability issue without any damages in. So I think, at least in terms of what the Supreme Court has said thus far, I do not believe that the Supreme Court, or even in Nuri, or the other cases that they relied upon, consider damages as one of the elements, if that answers the question, Your Honor.
If I could ask another question, following up on the question I asked Mr. Peltz, given the I take it you have not appealed the ruling of the court that the liquidated damages clause is enforceable, right?
That is correct, at the direction of my clients, yes.
So given that fact, is this contract an illusory contract? Is there a contract at all?
Oh, absolutely there is a contract, Your Honor. The complaint alleges that certain things were supposed to be done. They weren't done. And as in a nutshell, what the court decided was that the other side basically manipulated their obligations that they agreed to do, that is to go out and secure a loan. They manipulated and did nothing, and therefore there was no contract. I think, as the court indicated, that it is a very slippery slope if parties are able to manipulate agreements and get out of them. The ramifications, whether it leads to damages or not, is a separate issue, as was in this case. This case probably would have had a whole different life had Mr. Cooksey survived and had Anna Lugo, the main culprit, if you will, at least from the appellant side, had not filed bankruptcy on the eve of trial. We probably would have had a better understanding of how that other side would have played out. I hope that answers your question, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The Wheeler decision by another division of this court pointed out that in a proper case, the trial court may rule that neither party prevailed and award no fees. Why was it an abuse of discretion for this court to effectively follow the Wheeler decision?
Judge, Your Honor, if I recall, I think that's the I believe that's an Erie case, but I know which case you're talking about. But in that case where that ruling came down, the reason the court had discretion is because you had two parties. I think there's been more than one case decided on this. There's been more than there were both parties won on a liability issue. So where both sides won on a liability issue, then the court had discretion to make a determination as to who was a prevailing party in that case in a fee-shifting consequence. I think Spencer resolved that particular issue, and it was more specific where that issue came up thereafter. Any more questions, or I'll soon finish?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, it is true that a court can determine that there is no prevailing party. I can't remember the case site, but I remember reading that case. But what I want to impress upon the court is that here was a situation where there was $0 in earnest money paid, and there was a waiver of claims. Let's say that they had put in $1 as earnest money, and there was still a waiver of claims. And the language in the contract is very specific. They're giving up a claim for specific performance. They're giving up any claim for damages. And let's say that the plaintiff wanted to bring a lawsuit for damages, and the breaching party says, here's your dollar. And the plaintiff persisted in bringing the lawsuit. Is that a situation where the court would find that the plaintiff was the prevailing party on liability and should be entitled to all of its attorney fees when the defendant's offering to pay the $1?
Well, Mr. Peltz, in your hypothetical, presumably what the court would do is would find, if it even reached the issue of breach, that there was a breach, but it was waived, in which case there wouldn't be that party against whom the breach had been committed wouldn't be the prevailing party, because the claim would have been waived. It's not our situation.
Well, but our situation is still a situation where there's an agreement among sophisticated investors that there's no damages. There's zero earnest money, and that's its exclusive remedy. And that's what the case went to trial on.
So you did not contest the issue of breach?
Well, we didn't completely give up the issue of breach, but we knew that it was a losing proposition because we knew our client hadn't given notice to the seller that they were not going to close.
So why didn't you save the trial court some time and confess that issue? I mean, you said it, you knew it was a losing issue. You just said it in open court. I guess I'm a little troubled that you're standing here asking for attorney fees when you fought the issue of breach and lost on it, and you were found to have breached. And you now admit that it was a losing proposition.
Well, the reason is, reason is that frankly, we didn't find out until the trial when the loan broker showed up and told us that she told Mr. Cooksey that the property appraised for only 50% of what the sale price was, and that she told Mr. Cooksey, and he was angry. I didn't know what the court was going to do. But the bottom line is...
The bottom line is, it sounds like you're claiming that the position of the plaintiff was frivolous. And
yes,
but we don't have a claim before us under an attorney's fees provision allowing for an award for a frivolous claim. We have a prevailing party provision. It sounds like you're conflating the two, and we have to keep our analysis separate. There's no appeal here that this was a frivolous and groundless claim and fees should have been awarded under Title 13.
Okay,
that I'm aware.
That's correct.
It's just a prevailing party provision.
Right.
So I don't see how arguing that this was a waste of time, essentially, to prove a breach necessarily gets you fees under prevailing party provision.
Your Honor, I appreciate that, but isn't this the case that Judge Rivera is talking about, though, in his dissent?
Well, Judge Rivera was in dissent.
I understand
you
that.
You have to follow the majority.
I understand. I agree. He was the dissent, but this is the case that he's referring to, and that's why I'm asking this court to reconsider this and look at this in light of Judge Rivera's dissent and find that Marie Lugo and Chris Warner were the prevailing parties. Because the only thing that Mr. Cooksey could have gotten through this case is $0. If the court found that this agreement was enforceable and not unconscionable based upon the sophistication of parties, the only thing that he could have prevailed upon was $0.
But didn't they take the position at trial that the clause was unenforceable?
they did take the position at trial that it was unenforceable.
So if they had prevailed on that claim, then they could have proved damages.
Yes.
But that goes to the damages. That doesn't go to whether or not the contract was breached.
Well, this is that special situation because the court found that that provision is unenforceable. And isn't that a risk that the plaintiff takes when they proceed on a case?
So you would use a hypothetical of a dollar. Supposing the case had been allowed to go to the jury and the jury awarded $1 in damages. In that case, who would be the prevailing party?
Well, under Spencer, I believe that the plaintiff would have been the prevailing party. I don't like the way Spencer reads as it relates to this case, and I think it's unreasonable considering some of the factors in this case. But in that particular case, he would have been the prevailing party, but he didn't get a dollar. He got nothing. And that's what the case is about. That was the essence of the case. That was the linchpin of this entire trial.
Understanding that there was no request for nominal damages, and they, as you point out, they weren't awarded, as I read the cases, though, if there is a failure to prove actual damages, which there was in this case because of this clause, the court is nevertheless to award nominal damages. So wasn't the court required to award nominal damages even though it didn't do so?
Well, I'm not sure. The reason is that if the parties have an agreement, they're sophisticated as investors, and they say the damage remedy is limited to what's set forth in the terms of the contract, doesn't that preclude a damage award of $1? And if it does, then they can't prevail.
Okay.
Normally, I would say that you're correct.
I think I understand your argument.
Okay. I have nothing further. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. This case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.